We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers, activists, and contributors to Mind Over Matters. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you both. Happy Labor Day weekend.
Yes.
Happy Labor Day weekend. We are just literally physically inches away from the KXP stage here for a bumper shoot.
Yeah. This place is going to be hopping probably by the time we're off the air. Mm-hmm. And the angry hordes will have to just, you know, elbow their way to the front.
And that is why we made sure that we have a good earthquake insurance. All right. So lots to cover this week, starting with a positive note, a good announcement coming out of Share.
Yeah, a lot of homeless news this week, which we'll get to. But let's start with early good news that for people who have probably noticed over the last few months, the unsanctioned homeless encampment that's been camped out with a couple hundred people in front of the King County Administration Building on James and Fifth, I guess, mm-hmm. and actually an adjacent protest encampment that was around the corner on a hill called Goat Hill. And, you know, those couple hundred people were protesting the lack of funding given by King County and the inadequate funding by the city that forced Share's 15 indoor shelters, which is the primary indoor emergency shelter for low bar admittance in Seattle. Those closed at the beginning of April for lack of funding. Then the 5 months since, homeless people themselves have been organizing that protest encampment, asking King County officials to restore the funding and provide more stable funding for indoor shelters, because most of the funding right now is going to Housing First, a housing track program that only serves a fraction of the homeless people who actually need shelter from night to night. The good news is they announced this week they have reached a final deal for restoring retroactive funding and providing funding for the rest of this year and 2017 to enable those shelters to reopen. And so this weekend, those protest encampments are being torn down and cleaned up, and the indoor shelters at 15 different churches around the Seattle area are getting ready for business again and will be reopening this coming week. So that's very, very good news. And it shows not only that once they have facts on the ground and hear from people, that the bureaucrats in charge of homelessness policy can better understand the reality of the barriers that face homeless people trying to find shelter and then trying to find a way to stabilize their lives and deal with other issues that they might have. But it also shows that homeless people themselves are really a good and often very articulate advocates for what they need in the specifics of daily life that make it easier for them to find housing. The problem is with things like the mayor's new task force on sweeps, which met for the first time this week and which I'm sure Maria talked about last week. The composition of that task force, Sally Clark, the former city council member, who really did very little to help homelessness issues during her decade or so on city council. She's one of the co-chairs of that task force. The other co-chair is former WSDOT Ferries Director David Mosley, whose primary qualification for this has nothing to do with homelessness. It's that he's part of the in club and understands bureaucracy. And, you know, you also have neighborhood representatives, and I use that term loosely because there are very serious issues with people doing unsanctioned encampments on the streets and the challenges that poses to businesses and residents in those neighborhoods. But the residential representatives are things like the Ballard Chamber and the Neighborhood Safety Alliance, the folks who were hiring private security guards in Magnolia, people whose basic idea of a sweeps policy is to play whack-a-mole with human lives and not do anything else. And that task force met for the first time this week. They're supposed to have recommendations by the end of the month, but conspicuously missing from that input is any input not only from homeless people themselves, the kind of folks who organized the protest encampment at King County Administration Building, but also even the people who were in the field and providing direct services for things like housing and food. Those voices simply are not part of the public policy debate, and that's a huge problem because the people making the public policy literally often don't have a clue to what would actually help the human beings. They just want to get them out of sight, basically, without any particular regard for how they could actually address the problem long term. We also have a really key hearing hearings coming up this week for city council dealing with homelessness issues and the sweeps. They proposed legislation put forward by five different nonprofits to change and codify Seattle's sweeps policy. And a lot of those reforms would be good. They don't go far enough, but they would be a step forward. But once again, the voices of people who are actually living on the street or dealing day-to-day with people living on the street are conspicuously missing. And so it'll be very interesting to see what the public testimony is like. I think there's going to be a lot of people who are there this coming week.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, and the city council has been on a two-week vacation. But next Tuesday, the council is going to convene to consider the mayor's revised proposal for evicting the remaining residents of the Jungle. The Jungle was a three-mile-long homeless encampment beneath and beside I-5 from Soto to Beacon Hill. After backpedaling on his original proposal to kick everyone out and build an enormous fence around the property.
Yeah, and he's backpedaled a couple of different times on that.
Yes, he has. The mayor now wants to relocate the remaining 100 or so residents to a vacant city lot, which I guess is better than rousting them and then trashing their belongings, which is how most sweeps are conducted. But it doesn't compare, of course, to the proposal that was made by nonprofits last week, which would require that the city have housing available for people before evicting them from tent encampments.
Which is simply not going to happen because there's no housing.
Yeah, there's just no housing. Of course, in preparation for next week's showdown, several city officials came out against that proposal, including the head of the Parks Department, the head of the Human Services Department, and Police Chief Kathleen O'Toole. They sent a letter to the city council saying that the proposal would legalize tent camping in the city of Seattle and that providing housing and social services to homeless people could bankrupt the city. And, you know, if that's true, which I don't necessarily believe that it would be true, then that would be a bad thing, sure. But, you know, it's something the city should have considered a lot sooner. And it's just been decades over which service providers and advocates for the homeless and for low-income people have been asking the city to come up with strategies to preserve affordable housing. And instead, the city has just let big real estate developers and landlords do whatever they wanted. So now the truth is, you know, in a civilized society, we as taxpayers have to pay to provide services, whether that's as preventative measures like preserving affordable housing or whether that's as after the fact, more expensive solutions like trying to rehouse folks who are homeless and in some cases chronically homeless with mental health issues or drug addiction problems like many of the folks who are remaining in the Jungle. Yes, it's expensive, but it has to be done.
And let's be clear, the lobbying that's being done by these different department heads is being coordinated by City Hall. And part of this is a power struggle. It's a struggle between Ed Murray, who the mayor, who wants his own approach to homelessness and doesn't want to be interfered with on it, and sort of second-tier nonprofits who deal indirectly with the homeless, things like the ACLU and Skitch and some of the other groups who propose the sweeps legislation.
Columbia Legal Services,
and they do really good work, but again, they're not the people who are actually on the streets. Those are missing not only from the mayor's approach, but also from the quote-unquote official opposition.
And so much of the folks at City Hall here only from real estate developers and the business community, and in their mind,
and angry residents.
Those are the folks who are number one and need to be served first. But when you're talking about social services and health and human services, the people who need to be served first are the people who are in the most need, and that is the homeless. And we're just not hearing their voice at City Hall.
Yeah, and you also had instead a debate that broke out this past week, and I think it started on Cairo Radio with one of the flame-throwing talk show hosts there about, hey, why don't we just take all of the homeless and put them on an island in Puget Sound, and that way they can rest and get their lives together And it's like it's such an absurd
idea. It's a Lord of the Flies kind of solution.
It's a Lord of the Flies kind of solution. There's no services there. Hey, let's take all the people who are the most powerless in our society and put them a long way away from shelter, food, housing, jobs, social services, any of that kind of stuff. But again, you hear from some of these neighborhood groups and you heard from some of the people calling into the radio show, and that sounds like a good idea to them because they just want people out of sight and out of mind. They're not actually even familiar with, let alone sympathetic to, the kind of needs that people have in order to ameliorate their situations. And it's simply not been part of public policy, and that's why we are where we are. And the thing about this is, you know, we talk about doing these after-the-fact measures, but Maria mentioned that it's a lot cheaper to do preventative measures and provide housing in the first place and keep people in their existing homes in the first place. And that needs to be happening right now, too, because homelessness is going to be a lot worse in a couple, 3 years because the rents aren't getting any cheaper. There are a lot of people. For the 10,000 people in King County who are homeless, there's at least triple that, according to the latest figures, who are on the edge and at risk of becoming homeless in the next year. These numbers are simply going to increase, and there's simply not the capacity to deal with them right now or any coherent public policy for how to deal with
them. Yeah, and you know, I hear a lot from people who think that a lot of the homeless in King County have come from out of the state, and that is simply not true. Studies have shown, and the government's own statistics have shown, that most of the people who are homeless in the city of Seattle come from within the state of Washington, not all of them from inside King County, because there has been a lot of folks from rural areas who have gone through bankruptcies, who have lost their homes. And of course, they have to end up, when they end up homeless, they have to go where the services are, and that means the nearest city. But it certainly is mostly people who have become homeless within the state of Washington.
All right. Moving on, Seattle, city of Seattle, having further problems with police reform legislation.
Yeah. At an August 15th hearing this year before U.S. District Judge James Robart, Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes pledged that the city would have a new police reform legislation plan drafted by Labor Day. This week, Attorney Holmes told the judge that the city would need more time to build.
Wait a minute. I thought they were supposed to have police reform legislation
done
like 3 years ago.
Yes. He told the judge that the city is going to need more time to build consensus among all the parties involved. This comes after the Seattle Police Officers Guild overwhelmingly voted down a new contract with the city that would have included a number of police reforms. Now, as Jav mentioned, Mayor Murray first proposed legislation back in November of 2014, supposedly based in part on recommendations made by the Community Police Commission. But the CPC has clashed with the mayor over pieces of his proposal since then, including
and most of those original recommendations were ignored.
Yeah, including the existence of a civilian review board and whether the CPC will continue to exist after the reform process is deemed completed by the judge. Now, Judge Robart, who's overseeing the reform process, has asked the city to come up with some kind of compromise with the CPC and the police department. In the past several weeks, Robart has expressed his opinion repeatedly that the reform process must go forward and that no one group, whether it be the mayor, the CPC, or the Seattle Police Officers Guild, will hold back the process.
And now, it is particularly scathing toward the SPOG.
Toward the Seattle Police Officers Guild. Now, it remains to be seen how he's going to respond to this new delay. The court could impose some reform measures if the judge determines that the city and or other groups are dragging their feet. It's been 4 years since the city entered into the consent decree with the Department of Justice. And some reforms have been implemented, and those that have been implemented have had some good outcomes. But there are many that haven't, and the big one, civilian oversight, is still pretty contentious and seems to be pretty far away.
Yeah, and some of those reforms also have been implemented, have had results, but still have a lot of resistance within the police department. And complicating this is if the judge winds up imposing housing reforms, which I suspect is going to happen, that's going to enormously complicate the contract negotiations between the city and the Guild because, of course, having rejected that contract last month, they still need to come up with a contract. And that's a process that's being weighed down by the Guild's resistance to the reform process. And frankly, Mayor Murray isn't particularly committed to that either, but he's got the court breathing down his neck. And so the court and the Guild really are the two parties here who are likely to clash, and that's going to complicate contract negotiations as well.
All right. Moving on to national and clashes, Donald Trump making more news this week. hard to ignore.
He flew down to Mexico to meet with the Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto. Please forgive me if I mispronounce his name.
No, that's correct.
Peña Nieto took a lot of criticism for this, with commentators from all sides of the political spectrum saying that he should never have met with a man that he has recently compared to Hitler and Mussolini.
Yeah, and he got a lot of Neville Chamberlain references for his efforts.
He did. Peña Nieto's approval ratings have been extremely low recently. And, you know, I think he took a gamble that by showing strength in his meeting with Donald Trump, that this would make him appear to be a tougher and stronger president. But in fact, their meeting came down to he said on Twitter, when Donald Trump asserted that Mexico will indeed pay for the wall, followed up by
which is pure nonsense.
Yeah, followed up by Peña Nieto, who tweeted that as they had discussed in person, Mexico would do no such thing. And in fact, Trump had another little Twitter war going on with former Mexican president Vicente Fox. Back when Trump first proposed the wall, Fox had commented that Mexico was not going to pay for any bleeping wall, and he used the F word.
And let's be clear, Fox is from the right wing corporate part of Mexico's political spectrum. Uh-huh. It's universal opposition down there.
Oh, yeah.
Trump.
And this week, Fox tweeted, "Trump not welcome in Mexico, not by me nor the 130 million Mexicans. Mexico is not yours to play with. Show some respect." Trump replied that Fox had also invited him to Mexico when Fox apologized for using the F-bomb earlier this year in reference to the wall, to which Fox quickly replied, quote, "I invited you to come and apologize to all Mexicans. Stop lying," end quote. Several Latino Trump supporters were also confronted by the harsh truth about their candidate just a few hours later when Trump flew back to the United States and gave his immigration policy speech at a campaign rally in Phoenix, Arizona. As it turns out, he does indeed have no immigration policy. After all, he still has only a deportation policy. And this put several of his Latino advisors up in arms, including Alfonso Aguilar, who's the director of the American Principles Project's Latino Partnership, who said, quote, "If you heard the speech last night, it was either self-deport or be deported." Also ditching Trump was Ramiro Pena, a pastor from Texas who sat on Trump's Latino Advisory Council before quitting just after Trump's Phoenix speech, calling the council a scam. And finally, Houston immigration attorney Jacob Monti, who also sat on the Hispanic Advisory Council, said of Trump, quote, "He used us as props," end quote. He called Trump a populist modern-day Father Coughlin who demonized immigrants. Father Coughlin was an anti-Semitic radio host back in the 1930s before World War II.
And an apologist for Hitler and Mussolini. And,
yeah.
And Trump's gotten a lot of comparisons to Coughlin the last year.
Now, I read his Phoenix speech. I thought, you know, this is his finally he's going to make some reasonable proposal about immigration.
Yeah, and I read it too.
It really was as bad as these three Republicans say it is. It's all, quote, it's all, you know, stuff about their murderers and rapists, kick them out, build a wall, hire a whole lot more goons for the police state. It really is a policy for a person who's too lazy to bother with a real immigration policy.
And who's racist enough to think that that's sufficient.
Yeah, and that it's okay to continue to make these slanderous statements.
All right. I guess enough of that for this week. Let's move on to the...
Sadly, we've got about at least another 2 months before we can completely ignore Donald Trump.
Yeah.
U.S. Supreme Court making an important ruling this week.
Yeah, the Supreme Court refused in a 4-4 tie because, of course, the Ninth Supreme Court justice has not been confirmed by the Republican-controlled Senate because they don't believe in confirming Democratic appointees, apparently. So there's a 4-4 tie after the death of Antonin Scalia last spring, and between the conservatives and the liberals on the court. And in that 4-4 split, the Supreme Court refused to reinstate the North Carolina voting ID laws that were struck down by a lower court last month. Those laws were ruled by the court to have explicitly been crafted to try and suppress minority voting. And they're among the most restrictive in the country, and they used several different approaches to try and disenfranchise people that the Republican-controlled state legislature and governor in North Carolina find inconvenient to have vote. This really is a testimony to Scalia's clogged arteries, because if he were still on the Supreme Court, those voting laws almost certainly would have been reinstated, and it would have disenfranchised tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people in time for the November elections. That could make a difference between Clinton or Trump winning North Carolina, and that really does speak to how ideologically polarized and how radical the court has become over the last decade. And having a new appointee on the Supreme Court has already made a difference, and that 4-4 split has made a lot of difference in several rulings over the past few months. And going forward, if Clinton indeed wins in November, the composition of the court is going to be, and especially if the Senate flips to Democratic control so they can actually confirm some of these justices, it's going to make a huge difference going forward in how the court rules on issues like this. There have been a number of rulings over the past couple of months that have struck down various voter ID laws, specifically because there's a 4-4 tie in the court now.
What I found really interesting about this this ruling from the appeals court that the Supreme Court was looking at, the appeals court had originally overturned these voter ID laws, was that the appeals court had said, you know, our ruling is partially based on fact. The folks who are in the legislature and the folks who supported the voter ID laws could not show that there had been any cases of voter fraud in North Carolina. And that, in fact, the likeliest method of voter fraud is absentee ballot. And of course, absentee ballots have been exempted from these voter ID laws because mostly white people utilize the absentee ballot voting process, not people of color. And so the appeals court decided that, yes, that means that many of these voter ID laws, which limit practices that are utilized mostly by people of color, were definitely discriminatory.
And that they were crafted explicitly to discriminate.
Be discriminatory, yeah. Yes. So I found that very interesting.
All right. Moving on. Major shipping company going bankrupt this week.
Yeah, you know, Seattle's Terminal 46 is used primarily by one company, the Korean shipping company Hanjin. This week, Hanjin sought to file bankruptcy when it failed to reach a deal with its creditors, including the South Korean government's central bank. Hanjin is the seventh largest shipping company in the world, and it has run up debts totaling $5.5 billion in U.S. dollars, even though the company is only worth less than $1 billion in total. Several of Hanjin's ships are now stranded at sea because ports won't allow the ships to come in for fear that Hanjin won't be able to pay their docking fees. Hanjin ships at other ports have been seized as collateral for unpaid debts, including one ship in Savannah, Georgia, one in Singapore, and at least 10 in Chinese ports. In the meantime, companies who own the cargo on those ships are out of luck unless Hanjin can strike a deal with another shipping company. But that means that the companies that own the cargo will have to pay loading fees and additional shipping costs to a second carrier, which, of course, is going to increase the cost of their products once they come to market. This affects everything from food, clothing, automobile shipments, and electronics that South Korean companies are world-renowned for. For example, Samsung ships about 40% of its goods with Hanjin, and LG ships about 20%. this, of course, also brings up the obvious question. How did Han Jin rack up all that debt without someone putting the brakes on what they were doing? Probably there's some fraud going on with the company, but also someone or a whole lot of someones really failed to do their due diligence when extending loans and credit to Han Jin. And, you know, if we're talking about a bunch of someones, which I am suspecting is the case, we would have to include the Port of Seattle in that category.
I was wondering about the port and how they're likely to handle the fact that, Han Jin has docking fees here and ships an enormous number of goods through the Port of Seattle. I can't imagine, just being familiar with the Port of Seattle's business practices in general, that they were not one of the companies that took Han Jin on faith and is still taking Han Jin on faith, even with their very bad credit prospects right now, because the Port of Seattle has been so consistent over the years in rolling over and asking corporations to rub their tummy rather than doing due diligence on who they do business with.
Yeah, so I find this kind of interesting that a company worth less than $1 billion can run up debt that's about 600% of their – that makes their debt-to-equity ratio about 600%, which is just outrageous. And there's no way that all the creditors are going to be able to recoup what fees are owed them, even if Han Jin sells off the ships that it owns. Yeah. There just is no way. And one of those creditors, of course, is going to be the Port of Seattle.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, sticking with mega corporation finances, Apple facing a major penalty in the European Union.
Yeah, the European Union has something that we lack here, a person who is called their competition enforcer. That person has told Apple Corporation that they need to pay a $14.5 billion in unpaid taxes to the government of Ireland. This comes after Apple had cut a special deal with the government of Ireland to reduce their tax rate so low that they pay something like $50 on, I believe it is, about every $1 million in profit that they make in Ireland. That's a tax rate that is so vanishingly low that it makes every other country's offers of "we will lower your taxes" seem out of the ballpark.
Yeah, and the Conservative, for people not familiar, the Conservative government in Ireland over the last decade has really tried to position that country as a tax haven for European business and people doing business in Europe.
Yeah.
And Apple has taken full advantage of that.
And so, Europe's competition enforcer has demanded that Ireland recoup some 10 years' worth of back taxes from Apple. Apple feels singled out, but I tell you that they just may be the very first of many more other companies that are going to have to do the same thing. Now, it's interesting. The United States Treasury Department has not come down on the side of the European competition enforcer. No, they've come down on the side of Apple, naturally, which shows you how much our government is devoted to helping the concerns of major businesses. Of course, it also could be because the U.S. Treasury Department wants to collect some of that money on their own. Apple has something like $230 billion in cash, just sitting in cash, stashed away overseas, which they have not paid any U.S. taxes on. And about $215 billion of that is stashed in Ireland.
And of course, Apple is only one of many, many, many corporations
who do
that
the
have,
same thing.
Have used offshore tax havens to avoid paying U.S. taxes, usually with the happy complicity of the U.S. government, which is kind of inexplicable in a lot of ways.
And the thing is these companies hold this money over the head of the U.S. government saying, you know, we would be happy to bring our money home and use it here in the U.S. economy if you will give us a tax amnesty for it. So if you let us bring it home and only pay like a nominal tax rate on it, then we'd be happy to bring it home and spend it here. But of course, that's like blackmail, really. It's saying, you know, I know you want to collect the taxes on our profits that for products that we make and sell here to customers abroad, but we're just not going to bring it back unless you give us an enormous tax break. And that's really, I think, very unfair.
And several of those large companies are located right here in the greater Seattle area.
Yes.
Yeah, not to mention any names.
Not to mention Microsoft.
All right. Vince.
Yeah. Well, as we mentioned, Bumbershoot is coming up this weekend on the other side of the hopefully shatterproof glass here. And we'll be going on all weekend at Seattle Center. So go check that out. A lot of really good bands that are playing. We also have coming up, as I mentioned, on Tuesday, a key hearing on Seattle City Council on a couple of things after they come back from Labor Day. That'll be at 2 o'clock at City Hall, City Council Chambers at City Hall at 5th and James. Also coming up on Wednesday night, September 7th at 7:30, former Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper, who has been supplanted over the past few years by people a lot less committed to reform than he was going to talk on how to fix America's police, a certainly germane local topic. It'll be $5 at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca in downtown Seattle. And then on Thursday, September 8th, a Town Hall event, but it is not going to be at Town Hall. That's going to be at the Connolly Complex at Seattle University. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the former NBA great who has kind of taken on a visible second career as a public commentator, especially on racial issues, published in Time Magazine and a number of other venues, and has really gotten a lot of popularity over the last couple of years. Very articulate, thoughtful voice on racial issues in America. He's going to be talking for his new book, Writings on the Wall, which I believe is a compilation of some of his essays. That will be at Seattle Center again at 7:30 at the Connolly Complex on Thursday, September 8th.
Seattle University.
Seattle University, yes.
All right.